Ready, Mr. Camacho.
Good morning. It's, according to my watch, it's 9:08 on Monday, September the 28th of 2009. I'm calling the case of OPA-PA09-005. That's in the appeal of Guam Community Improvement Foundation, Inc. We are on the sixth floor of the DNA building in Agana, Guam, which is a DISID conference room. I am Anthony R. Camacho, hearing officer for the Office of the Public Auditor. I will preside as hearing officer for these proceedings today. Will the other members of the OPA staff please identify themselves for the record?
Doris Flores, Public Auditor.
Laura Harris, Audit Supervisor. Pam Camacho, Administrative Officer.
Are the, is counsel for the appellant present?
Yes, Randall Cunliff on behalf of Guam Community Improvement Foundation.
Is there an appellant representative with you?
Yes, Mr. Anthony Skrill.
Is the purchasing agency's counsel present?
Yes, Mr. Camacho, my name is Ben Abrams. I'm with the Attorney General's Office. We have the Director of Public Works in our way.
Could you identify him by name, please?
Harris. Okay. And Mr. John Watsonberger is co-counsel with me on this, and he's further to my right. And I suspect he's saying he needs yourself.
That's nice. Are there any interested parties that have formally submitted their entry of appearance in this matter?
Yes, good morning, Mr.
Okay. And I know we're kind of short seats here. We're going to resolve that at the first break. Today, so that all parties and their institutional representatives can sit with their counsel. Pursuant to the September 16, 2009 scheduling order, the first, or basically we're going to have the hearings for the purchasing agency's motion for a protective order and their motion for the public auditor to confirm their declaration of substantial interest in this matter. Are there any other, are there any preliminary issues by any of the parties before we begin those proceedings? Okay. As we begin, just a couple of reminders. Of course, in my hearings, I request that the parties treat each other with dignity and respect. Likewise, I ask that the members of the public who are here to observe these proceedings treat each other and the parties the same. Further, as these proceedings are being recorded, I ask that the parties and any witnesses in the matter speak loudly into their microphones, which have been provided for them. At this time, are there any witnesses or any, do any parties have witnesses present for the hearing for substantial interest?
The purchasing agency has several witnesses who are present.
That is correct. I would prefer the witnesses be sequestered before we proceed further on that issue of witnesses. I understand that, or it's at least my belief based on the filing of the both parties, that we're not going to have witnesses for the motion for protective order. Is that correct?
I didn't intend to.
Okay. So the way I intend to proceed is we're going to hear the motion for protective order first. Okay. We will sequester the witnesses before that, and when we're done hearing argument on the motions for a protective order, we're going to immediately proceed into the substantial interest hearing. Is that okay with the parties?
That's fine.
That's fine, Your Honor. Mr. Camacho, we just to clarify, the witnesses should be excused prior to the substantial interest portion of the hearing. Is that good?
Well, I'd like them secured now, simply because I don't intend to take a break between the two hearings, and we're just going to go right into the substantial interest hearing. Okay. Does the appellant have any witnesses?
We have one potential witness here as well.
Okay. And likewise, could you please could you identify them for the record, please?
Joshua Tenorio.
Okay. I ask that Mr. Tenorio also be sequestered and leave the hearing. Okay. Who are your witnesses today, Mr. Abrams, for the purchasing agency?
Well, as listed on our exhibit and witness list, we have the director of the Director of Public Works and the Life and Soil Affairs. Then we have the JFK school principal, Mr. Ken Shagalow. We have Eunice Applicley. We have we have Dieter, Mr. Tony Gloss from Dieter, and we have,
so all the parties mentioned,
all the witnesses,
okay, are none of them present in the room at this time? I understand Mr. Perez and Mr. Stroh are here, but as there are the institutional reps, that rule will not apply to them. Ms. Tang, are you going to present any witnesses today?
No, thank you.
Okay. All right, then, pursuant to the September 16th, 2009 scheduling order, the first matter that we are going to hear today is the purchasing agency's motion for a protective order. And I have the pleadings of the parties. I actually have the purchasing agency's motion for a protective order. Mr. Cunliffe, I have your opposition to the same, and likewise I have your reply to Mr. Cunliffe's opposition. We're going to proceed just like any other motion hearing that you're familiar with in the court, and we're going to begin with the argument by Mr. Abrams, to be followed by argument by Mr. Cunliffe. As this is your motion, Mr. Abrams, I will allow you very brief rebuttal to any of Mr. Cunliffe's arguments. Okay. Having said that, you have the floor, Mr. Abrams.
I really have little to add to our written submissions. What I would like to underscore is that we have the purchasing agency Public Works has definitely not made an award at this point. No award has been made, no contracts have been signed, no leases in place, no final documentation that would be consistent with an award has been made. There was a selection of IBC as the preferred bidder, and financing was very close to being put in place. But we have no award. The regulations governing the disclosure of proprietary information in this jurisdiction are pre-award confidentiality regulations. And that's pretty much it. Now, Mr. Cunliffe is doubtless going to argue that, in effect, as he has in writing, in effect, there has been an award. But that's far from the case. The most important part of the bid procurement procedure was the financing part, and that still remains to be completed. So we don't have an award situation or anything like it. In the event that this sensitive material was exchange between the three bidders, and the project will have to rebid, you can imagine the chaos and the compromises that would result from that. So we are counting on the Office of Public Accountability to maintain the the wall of confidentiality between all three bid proposals, and to keep them under seal and be only in camera, unless there are other numbers disclosed in legal ways. That's all I basically have to say about it, Mr. Camacho, but I'm open to any questions if you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Abrams. Mr. Crumlin.
Thank you, Mr. Camacho. As Mr. Abrams has pointed out, of course, there is a difficulty on behalf of a protester in having a full disclosure of what the proceedings are and how everything's going to go forward and whether or not there is compliance with the bidding process when no one is given the various documents upon which the selection was made. And, you know, the indication is that there has no award been made. And I think we're playing a shell game here, trying to hide the pea under one of the shells. We have information made public that the documents for obtaining financing issued on the internet available to anyone. The documents say that a lease has been entered into as of August 1st. Mr. Abrams says a lease has not been entered into. Somebody's not telling the truth. And I suspect maybe the people who are trying to obtain financing aren't telling the truth when they say to their prospective investors, a lease has been entered into. So we don't know because we don't have all of these documents. Under 2 GAR 3114H1, it requires those documents to be attached to their submittals. And, you know, I understand under the abundance of caution, they have submitted the first page of those documents, but they have not submitted them claiming they are proprietary. How can someone be claiming to represent this interest and obtain money to build this project if they have not been awarded the project? They may not have signed a document saying award, but they scheduled a groundbreaking between IBC, GEDA, Public Works, the Department of Education at the site. How can they have a groundbreaking if they haven't had an award? They're asking to go forward under the next motion and have the contract begin. How can they do that if there hasn't been an award? So the decision they cite, the California Michaelis, Montanari and Johnson versus Superior Court, as we pointed out, was very instructive because they'd made an award, but it hadn't been approved by the Department of Education, the board that needed to sign off on it. And had that been approved, those documents were readily available. In this case, everybody's acting as if the contract has been approved. IBC and their partners have said in hundreds of pages of documents that they have a lease, which is a 30-year lease for the property. They have a groundbreaking schedule. They want to go forward with the contract and begin the construction project in the substantial interest of the government of Guam, and yet there has not been an award. And for the parties to present this case appropriately and in full candor to yourself and the public auditor, it is necessary to be able to establish the failures in that process, which we've alluded to from our understanding that because these documents are considered proprietary and not being released, we can't validate the inadequacies of the procurement process. And I understand quite well Mr. Abrams' argument that if this is put out for rebid, you know, there may be some difficulties because people have seen each other's various documents. But that be the case, as we've pointed out in our exhibit lists, the legislature has pending before it a bill that will completely change this procurement process. It won't be a finance, construct, and design and construct. It'll just be a design and construct and be financed by the government of Guam. So that under the request for proposal that was submitted, it was a 70% weighted on the financing. That's no longer going to be the case if, in fact, this legislation is enacted and this whole bid process is thrown out anyway by the legislature, so that what is contained in those documents is not nearly as significant based upon the apparent intent of the legislature to change this whole system. And we would therefore ask and believe it necessary that those documents be made available. And Mr. Camacho, as the hearing officer, you can make orders that we keep those secure and not make them public except to the parties in this action before this commission, so that it's not something that is written up in the newspapers and copied down and made available to on the internet or anything like that. You can put a protective order in place that they be maintained secure and privileged under those circumstances. Thank you.
Mr. Abrams?
One minute,
Mr. Abrams. Okay.
I apologize, Mr. Abrams. Do you have any brief rebuttal to Mr. Funnel's
argument? Yes, I do, and if you don't mind, I think Ms. Tang has some arguments to present.
That's after your rebuttal.
I don't have a lot of rebuttal here, but Mr. Funnel talks about a shell game, and I'm talking about speculation. The bill that he's talking about is not part of the legal landscape at this point. It's a speculative piece of legislation that may or may not be passed in any form that we now see it, and we can't proceed on the basis of what might happen as projected. Secondly, there has been no lease signed. If there were a signed lease, for sure we would have included it in the procurement record. We would be required to. That's not. There might be a draft lease out there, but that's anticipatory. And no signed lease has been made. And I think Mr. Cummings knows that. Also, this so-called groundbreaking that I heard Mr. Cummings refer to once or twice, that is not a groundbreaking by the government. If there was one, it was, you know, we've all seen signs of exuberance and nostalgia and emotional commitment by the faculty and staff at JFK, probably for very good reasons. Sometimes they get a little carried away, like anyone does when they interpret the reason or something. And if there was such a groundbreaking, it was probably a symbolic gesture by the students, maybe some of their supporters, to go out and say, we're breaking ground. But that's not the same as the government making a contract to war. And the construction company, the one in the war, going out and starting construction, that's not what happened at all. Nothing like that happened. There's no war. And we don't know for sure if IBC is going to be or be landed in the war. This is something I have to make clear. It could be that, depending on how the substantial interest here goes, depending on whether we get confirmation of the determination of substantial interest in the bid procurement goes forward. It could well be that IBC won't, as the last hurdle, won't be able to come across it. Number two or number three, maybe Mr. Cummings' client will be the one that breaks that. We just don't know. they're that far away from an award, so that we can't really pick a winner yet. It's not in the bag for IBC, because remember, the most difficult part of this procurement process has yet to take place. We're very close to it, but it has, there's no cigar system. So, in short, there's only a pending bill that Mr. Pellet can allude to. There's been no groundbreaking of an official nature, if at all. And certainly, the lease on it. And that's all I have to say about it. Thank you very much.
Okay, now, Mr. Tang, I understand you wanted to make a statement. Before we begin with that, Mr. Cunliffe, I'm going to allow you to address Ms. Tang's statement and have a brief argument, response, because I understand you made no pleadings on this issue?
No.
Okay, and, so you do join in. I'll allow you also, Mr. Abrams, at the end to make a brief comment as well, and you may proceed, Ms. Tang.
Thank you. A couple of points. First, there has been no award. It's undisputed. There's no evidence of award. Yes, we've come close to an award, but it hasn't happened. And the mandate of two guards, 3-1-1-B, is that there shall be no disclosure required to an award without the consent of the proposer. There has been no consent on IBC's part. No disclosure. Council refers to the OPA Section 2-1-2-105. And we don't think there's any inconsistency here. And the reason is because Section D and E of that section makes it very clear. D, subsection D states, copy of the abstract of legal offers, the relevant abortions thereof are going to protest. E, any other documents which are relevant to a protest. Now, what is relevant to a protest? I think we all know what this hearing is about today, substantial interest. What's relevant is not the disclosure of IBC bid. There's absolutely no basis, and they certainly have not made any argument, factual or otherwise, or legal arguments, haven't cited a single case in support of that position. So they're just saying, well, we're in this whining and they're in the disadvantage, we want to see it. But this is a substantial interest hearing. Let's not forget that. It is not, 2-bar section 12105 does not require disclosure of IBC's proposal. They refer to the McAllis case. The McAllis case is instructive, as the government has stated in its reply. For very good reason, and I think Council, or GCIS, missed the point of that case. First page of that case states, holding in bold, the Supreme Court held, Supreme Court of California, that proposals were exempt from disclosure until cities had completed negotiations. That was the clear holding of that case. This day, we get close to concluding negotiations or on the eve of signing the contract was clear. The holding says no disclosure until negotiations are completed. We don't need to argue about that. And there's a very good policy reason, and it's discussed in this case, why disclosure should not be had before an award. It's because it gives the agency, purchasing the agency, the ability to negotiate. If one, for some reason, this first thing proposal doesn't work out or pulls out, then it allows the purchasing agency to go negotiate with the next offer one. That's the policy reason behind this non-disclosure rule prior to award. Now, another point I'd like to make is, McAllis is instructive in that it's different because there was a lease that was approved by a board, but California law, not the procurement model procurement code or the one topic of law, the California statute said prior to giving the board approval, it can be disclosed. Guam has no such statute. And that is a big difference in that case. But that case was particularly on point and instructive because the issue was whether disclosure can be made prior to the end of during negotiation, prior to it going before the board. And the court specifically held on the first page, right under the caption of the case, no, it cannot. There has been no award. Our IBC documents and proposals are confidential with Smith's form law, and they should not be disclosed. Thank you.
Mr. Kamel?
Thank you, Mr. Camacho. First, I would point out that this is not a substantial interest hearing. This is a hearing on whether or not the motion filed for protective order is going to be granted. So that statement by counsel is inaccurate. And we would just indicate that, as counsel has pointed out, California law is different. They didn't adopt their law from the uniform procurement code, as Guam did, along with 17 other jurisdictions in the United States. But the indication in that case, which counsel says I missed the point, was that once the award has been made, it's available. And we believe, although they protest this a great deal that no award has been made, that based upon all of the facts in this case, they know where they're going to award the matter. They just haven't signed, they didn't sign the document, and therefore they're just saying, well, we haven't signed a document saying we award it to IBC, and therefore we don't have to make these documents available. Yet they're saying in the next motion, let us award this matter to IBC. Well, if the substantial interest is signed, then do we get the documents? Thank you.
Mr. Abrams, as this is your motion, I'll leave you with the last word, but be brief. And this is based just on the, and limit your comments and rebuttal just to Mr. Cummins' comments on
I want to have the opportunity to respond, but you know, I didn't hear anything that he said that I really feel we need to rebut. Ms. Tang's presentation was very active. And there are parts of the hearing on this confidentiality motion for a protective order issue which overlap into the substantial interest issue tangentially. And I think Ms. Tang was joyous and certainly within the scope of this hearing in making the references to substantial interest that she did. So we're all mindful of the nature of this hearing. And Mr. Cummins obviously sees the law differently than we do. And I think that the record at this point well documents our respective positions without any other argument from us. If there are any questions that you feel we need to answer that maybe we haven't addressed, we're certainly receptive to addressing any questions like that. So are we ready to submit?
This time, thank you for the argument and the pleadings of the parties. I'm going to take this issue under advisement and issue a written decision shortly after these proceedings. The next matter that we are going to take up pursuant to the scheduling order is the substantial interest hearing. Now, I understand that the purchasing agency and the appellant both have witnesses and argument. Ms. Tang, did you submit a witness list?
No.
I'm not. Yeah, just Mr. Kamaki. We'll do.
We don't have any additional witnesses.
Okay, so what I... Okay, what I will do is I will allow you to argue after Mr. Abrams, okay, in that order. So after Mr. Abrams gives his opening statement, I will allow you to give an opening statement after Mr. Abrams has his presentation of evidence or to question witnesses. I will allow you to do the same, okay? That's just to move the proceeding along and not have to... different proceedings. Likewise, I'll allow you to give a closing statement after Mr. Abrams gives his closing statement. So basically, you'll follow Mr. Abrams during the different phases of this proceeding. Is that understood by all the parties? Okay. And pursuant to the September 16th scheduling order, we will proceed with a substantial interest hearing with the purchasing agency's opening statement. Mr. Abrams, the floor is once again yours.
Thank you very much. What we're here to do is to make it clear to the OTA that there is, without any questions, a substantial interest on the part of the territory of Guam to proceed with their procurement. This whole matter originated with emergency legislation by the legislature to set the tone for the whole JFK reconstruction project and the procurement procedure that leads up to. The Department of Public Works has proceeded with alacrity in the RFP and the procedures subsequent to the IFP. Allow me to point out that when we talk about substantial interest in allowing the bid procurement process to go ahead, we're doing several things. The first thing, of course, that we're doing is allowing the final step in which DPW was on the brink of completing when the first protest was filed, and that is placement of financing. Well, there's no guarantee that IBC is going to be able to do that as they would have been able to before. We don't know. If the OPA confirms substantial interest and the procedure does progress, we will find out how able IBC is to secure that finance. If they're not successful, it goes to the number two selected bidder and the number three selected bidder, conceivably. And that process takes time and should be allowed to go forward. Or else, what's the option? What's the alternative? The alternative would be to let the JFK rebuild die. Despite the fact that the legislature has made it the subject of an emergency piece of legislation, not to confirm the substantial interest would be the death knell for reconstruction of JFK High School at the original location. Why do I say that? Well, it doesn't take a lawyer to know that we have two appeals pending, and if history is any instructor to us, we know that the unsuccessful party to those two hearings is doubtless going to go to the Superior Court. And then there's even a third appellate level after that. It goes to the Supreme Court. And you can crunch the numbers, but even in an ideal situation where appeals are handled that expeditiously, which is not always the case here, we could be looking at another 2 years before all those appeals are decided, and then maybe it's going to be a remand if the clock keeps ticking. We definitely think it's obvious that the students and the taxpayers of Guam deserve something better than that. They deserve that the will of their elected representatives in the legislature, having declared this an emergency in the subject of emergency legislation, should be allowed to proceed. And there are two reasons why. Substantial interest rubric, we have two components. We have children who are suffering because they're not getting the kind of education required by law. That's one component.
And the second component to bifurcate this is the interest of the taxpayers in getting a cost-effective rebuild of the JFK school. And again, it doesn't take an expert from GM, they're prepared to testify. And it doesn't take a degree in finance or economics to understand that the longer we wait to put financing in place, the more expensive it's going to be. Not only is it going to be more expensive for the finance, right, the interest rate and the terms of the finance, but intrinsically, the price of the construction materials is going to see a hike. You know, we all read the newspapers and we know that there's a construction boom supposedly going to occur here. And this is going to conceivably mean a shortage of construction materials and the intended price increase. And I see nothing but escalation in the cost of the JFK project if it's not allowed to proceed expeditiously. And that also is a substantial interest in the territory in terms of taxpayers' dollars and tight budgets and everything else that we've seen in the present-day economy. It makes finances tight. We've got to go ahead with this project. Now, going back to the first component of the substantial interest, we've got an act here in the territory, and forgive me if I'm not saying it quite the right way, is every child gets a adequate education. You know, in that piece of legislation, in the first few lines, it says the priority of Guam, not a priority of Guam, the priority of the government of Guam is an adequate education for our children. That's the number one priority, and they equate this right to a constitutional right in that legislation. Now, you have to decide. Are the children of Guam suffering because they have to go to school at a temporary student campus? Well, the evidence is going to show they're definitely suffering. They're suffering in two ways. Number one, they're not getting an education. Who ever heard of a high school without a library? I've been out there. Not a book. I repeat, no library, no book. I was astounded. We have witnesses who will testify this today. Guess what else? No chemistry laboratory. There's a very small chemistry classroom. They have no lab. They have not one petri dish. They have not one Bunsen burner. They have not one microscope. Now, this is the kind of facility that 2,300 of our most deserving children are having to undergo. Is there a substantial interest in expediting the process that will give them a decent high school? I say to you that there is. So we have two compelling components of the substantial interest category. We have the taxpayers who shouldn't have to pay more just because of these appeals being filed. Let the appeals run their course. But at the same time, let the children have what they deserve and let the taxpayers have what they deserve too, which is to lock in the financing at the lowest possible finance project cost. And that's what our evidence will show. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Abrams. Ms. Tang?
I'll be very brief. Not much to add to Mr. Stevens opening, because that I think the closure of JFK occurred over a year ago, in June 08. The governor declared emergency, not with simple rate. In March 09 this year, the parties were notified of the ranking of the proposal so that the construction of the school can go forward. We are now in September. Last month, IDC was ready, supported, and enabled to proceed with the financing and construction of the school. The ease of going to the market could be possible. Is coincidental, perhaps? IDC was able to get financing despite those crises in the financial market. IDC was able to line up, you know, millions, tens of millions to get the school built where many vendors were scared to even look at any kind of investment they want.
It's a very difficult market. And the longer that these proceedings continue, the more risk we put. The less likely that the school will go up there. I think that, you know, will certainly affect the financial factors. And I think that this office, the OPA, is in a good position to support the government, support the students, support the kids who desperately need a school. And to show that this is important, this is not just a declaration by the government, this is something that is absolutely necessary, and put a very strong decision, writing a very strong decision, telling the proposers, that the people challenging the proposal, that this is important. If you have a valid claim, then go forward, but if you don't, this is dilatory, then we really need to do the right thing. Thank you.